Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
The FT.
Hello and welcome to the Arts Podcast. I'm Andrew Hill, the FT's management editor, and this week we turn our attention to films that portray the financial crisis. The latest of these is Margin Call, a fictionalised account of 24 desperate hours at a Wall Street investment bank in 2008 as it attempts to save itself from a disaster of its own making. Written and directed by first-time feature director J.C. Chandor and starring Kevin Spacey, Demi Moore and Jeremy Irons, among others, it was described by The New Yorker as the best Wall Street movie ever made. It's been marketed as a thriller, but how do you create excitement when the action consists of men in suits peering at computer screens and talking on BlackBerries? Does Margin Call have anything new to say on the much-debated causes of the collapse? With me to discuss these questions are Alex Preston, ex-City trader and author of This Bleeding City, Peter Aspden, FT arts writer, and Leo Robson, film and television critic. But before I turn to them, let's listen to a clip from the film.
The real question is, who are we selling this to?
Same people we've been selling it to for the last 2 years, and whoever else will buy it.
But John, if you do this, you will kill the market for years. It's over. And you're selling something that you know has no value.
We are selling to willing buyers at the current fair market price so that we may survive.
You will never sell anything to any of those people ever again.
I understand.
Do you?
Do you? This is it. I'm telling you, this is it.
Kevin Spacey and Jeremy Irons there. Alex, to turn to you first, thank you for joining us. You're the only one of us who's seen inside this kind of situation. What did you make of the film?
I thought probably the New Yorkers in Comeo were rather over the top, but I did think it was a very good film. And I think perhaps it is the best film ever made about Wall Street, but I think that says more about Wall Street films than it does about this particular film. I thought it was very, very good. I thought it was very convincing. J.C. Chandor, the writer and director, is the son of a 40-year Merrill Lynch banker, 40-year veteran of Merrill Lynch, and I think you can tell that. The dialogue is absolutely spot on. I thought it was wonderful. I think it very much follows on from The Social Network in terms of a film that doesn't patronise the audience. It is complex in many ways, and it shows you can do a smart office drama, and I think in that it works well. Also reminded me of a play. I thought it was very kind of condensed in this office where they film it, and that, you know, maybe it comes on from something like Enron. I mean, it doesn't have that farce element of Enron, but it does have, you know, it does the tension. It's this 36-hour period in these guys' lives, and time almost seems to stand still in there. It's you know, it is a magnificent film.
Peter, do you agree?
Yeah, I do, absolutely. And what I loved about it is that it actually doesn't try too hard to explain things. It's not that technical. I mean, there are bits that are difficult, and there are a few initials that a lot of people won't pick up on. But it focuses on it tries to zero in on a more profound theme, really. It tries to kind of tell us something about the human condition. And the big question really is, what does motivate us to keep wanting so much more money? You know, the greed involved. I mean, it really tries to get there. You know, there are two quite decent characters, at least two, who you would think would be able to get out, but they're both trapped, and they're both trapped because they want more money or need more money.
Do you worry that it humanizes a bit too much the authors of the crash in that way, or is that a good thing?
No, because I don't think you don't get that sense with the Jeremy Irons character. I mean, I think it has a nice spread of characters. I think the morality is quite evenly balanced. I mean, clearly the Kevin Spacey character is, a good guy, but, you know.
But surely that's also the point. You know, this is something that I feel very strongly about the fiction that has dealt with the financial crisis. We actually need to humanise some of these characters, because setting bankers up as these Lex Luthor figures, as these kind of comic book villains, as has been done, you know, particularly I thought in Sebastian Foulkes' Week in in December.
Not a good book, I have to say.
Oh, I actually thought it was rather good. Apart from, I thought that the places it struggles are the bits dealing with the financial crisis, partly because it kind of delves very deeply and journalistically into the world of the CDS and the ABS and the CDO. But I absolutely agree with Peter that I think what you need is, you know, understanding CDOs to explain the financial crisis is like understanding machine gun mechanisms to explain war. You want to know what drove this generation of bright, educated people to jettison their morality at a period at some point in the first half of the last century and to understand that you have to get the human story underneath it. And I think that's absolutely what it does. It's absolutely right that the financial, you know, the complexities of exactly what is going wrong with the financial side of the bank are left something of an enigma, because it's a MacGuffin. It just drives along the plot, and what you get is you get what drives these people. Why do they need all this money? Why are they putting greed above morality?
Leo, you've seen a lot of these movies and documentaries, dramatisations of the crisis and so on, and you wrote last weekend that so far the TV programmes seem to display great interest in the scary and the scandalous, but little beyond that. Does this go beyond that?
I think it goes beyond that to a certain extent, but it also demonstrates that same interest. What I meant was that the programmes are very devoted to unraveling a lot of detail, which shows beyond all doubt, almost like a legal argument, that what these people did was foolish and myopic and selfish. And I think we know that now. It's been established. We've had enough now, as Alex was sort of hinting at what really happened, you know, what the disasters, what form the disasters took. And I think this film might represent a move at a slightly more historical, slightly less journalistic account of the human motives, rather than just the human acts that caused all the trouble in 2008.
I mean, you've hinted, Alex, that the fiction may be slightly better placed then to get under the skin of this crisis. Is that your sense?
Well, I think that, you know, you obviously within the time space that you have in a film, you have to simplify so much, and the novel gives you more space to play out the various themes. And you know, I do think that literary fiction is one of the few boom areas in this recent downturn, because you now have five or six very, very fine novels that are set more or less against the financial world. And, you know, I mean, from the US you have Union Atlantic and you have The Privileges, which I thought were both excellent, excellent novels. Over here you have, you know, whatever we think of Mr. Folks, it was a very successful novel. I thought that The Fear Index by Robert Harris was a really interesting thriller set against the financial. And then John Lanchester's Capital, which is out in, I think, February or March, and is an exceptional novel, and really perhaps succeeds in many ways where A Week in December didn't.
Peter, in between sort of novels and movies and possibly bringing in documentaries, where do you feel the best explanations of a crisis this technical
from? It's so complex, I think you need to take a sort of balanced diet of all of them. I mean, I agree with Alex. I think fiction can definitely go further and more profoundly into what motivates these people. But I wouldn't write off the documentaries as well. You know, they can be, I mean, I thought Inside Story, you know, I watched that.
Inside Job.
I watched it on TV, and I was late at night and I couldn't get to sleep. It just made me so angry, you know, and I think it was a very clever style that, you know, it was very seemingly unassuming, quite gentle questions, which gradually ratcheted up until a lot of these people just, they couldn't, you know, they kind of couldn't answer back. And that had quite a lot of power.
I quite liked the fact that in Margin Call, the blame is not laid directly on all the characters. There's a sense in which you are supposed to obviously sympathise with some of the characters. Lee, I don't know whether you thought that there were villains in this movie, outright villains in this movie.
I think I don't really accept Alex's distinction between literary fiction and a movie, which is a work of fiction, though in this case based in some particulars on Dick Fold and Lehman Brothers. I think that most works of fiction, especially that are dealing with behaviour, which is so often defined as being incredible, unbelievable, how could it happen, etc., has the obligation to justify everyone from their own point of view. And even John Tulled, the suave character played by Jeremy Irons, who's channeling a bit of Daniel Day-Lewis and There Will Be Blood, a kind of mid-Atlantic accent of sort of grand suavity, and he's very extraordinarily sort of patrician and above it all, he sees the people on the ground as, well, they're irrelevances to him, as they would be if you travel by helicopter. I think that even he's given a fair go at setting out his position. He has maybe 3-4 speeches in all kinds of different places within the very.
And he's not a proper villain. I mean, he's a villain because of what we know happens afterwards. But I mean, he's operating by the rules of a market in which he lives, and so I thought that it was very nicely done that you are, because of course this is one of the things that, you know, not everyone that worked in finance was a villain. Not everyone understood. I did think maybe a little too often they say, speak to me as if I'm a child, speak to me as if I'm a golden retriever. You know, this idea of trying to get things put on the table, exactly how does it work? And that to me, you know, I mean, I guess it represents the fact that of 10,000 people working in a bank, probably 25 or 30 actually understood the tranched mortgage products that went wrong. But
in the film that the people who don't know and say, talk to me in English, or as Paul Bettany's character, Will Emerson, says, what the do I know, are the people who are in charge.
Aren't they? Absolutely. The but that, and that's spot CEO. On.
Yes, yeah. I agree. I think there's also some interesting speeches in there where the blame is laid more widely on sort of society. And does that ring true? I wonder whether that makes a bit.
I mean, I think absolutely that, you know, that this is the great information imbalance that is one of the tragedies of the past 5 years or so, which is the people on Wall Street who are saying, or in the city here, who are saying, yes, absolutely, you know, but everyone's to blame. We all lived on easy credit. Well, but you guys understood what was going on, or you should have done. Whereas the people on the street who were taking out these ridiculous mortgages just thought that we were in a new era of economic prosperity. And I think that it plays those nicely, although perhaps comes down a little too firmly on the side of the Wall Streeters kind of disappearing into these circular arguments, trying to exonerate themselves.
When we had two bankers look at this movie when it came out in the States, they seemed to be sort of in two minds, really. On one point, that it wasn't actually accurate enough for bankers, and they wouldn't want to go and see it and live through it again anyway. And for everyone else, possibly not judgmental enough on the bankers.
That's very interesting. That came up a lot in the. I was reading through reviews in the States, and there were these kind of very polarized views of whether it gave you too much information, whether it gave you too little, whether it was too kind to the bankers, whether it wasn't kind enough. And actually, I think that's probably what he was trying to do. He was trying to tread this very fine moral line between exonerating and over blaming the bankers involved.
Peter, what do you think about the sort of timing of this? Obviously, if you read the Financial Times and other papers, we're still in the middle of a crisis, a different type of crisis, but a crisis nonetheless, and we're still blaming bankers. But this has come out only 3 years after. Is it too soon, too late?
It's part of a thing that has to keep going on. You know, we can't just put it behind us. I think the events of 2008 were epochal, you know, and we have to keep investigating it and finding out. And, you know, the Financial Services Authority report just came out this week, you know, revealed new outrages, including a very senior management figure who didn't fully understand what CDOs were, I believe.
You know? Yes, Royal Bank of Scotland.
Yes, indeed, yeah. So, we have to keep exploring this theme. It's picking at it like a scab, I think, but it's very necessary.
And when does the best art emerge from these types of crises, Leo? I mean, the certainly from my point of view, looking at books that have been written on the factual side of it, there's a genuine sense that I have that the great sort of histories of the crash will really not come out for another decade or so.
Yeah,
as happened after the 1930s.
I think that movies have an incredible ability to be sort of journalism and art at the same time. Citizen Kane being a prime example, made when Hearst was still going, and in the 70s, in the early 70s, the Parallax View, All the President's Men, all those kind of Watergate or sort of proto-Watergate films of paranoia, suspicion, and so forth. They got to it very quick. I think it's right about the books, though. But the problem, the difference between this and many, many historical phenomena is that it's not only extraordinarily complex, but it's totally defined by its complexity. So people are going to get away with, and I don't mean that in a corner-cutting way, but they are going to get away with telling the story, explaining it to lay readers for quite a while before we're going to achieve that kind of perspective. And so many of the books, even the really, really excellent ones, like Aaron Ross Sorkin's book, that's just a torrent of fact and detail and testimony and I think what they call deep background, where you chat to everyone but can't say who told you what.
That's like David Hare's The Power of Yes. You know, it was a play that wasn't a play. It was just a journalist asking a lot of questions.
Yeah, sort of oral history.
You know, the genesis of that play is really interesting because Nick Heitner told me that that started by him talking to David Hare in a telephone conversation and Heitner saying, by the way, I don't really understand any of this financial crisis. And David Hare said, by the way, nor do I. And Heitner said, then we should do a play about it. And, you know, and with his ideas of using theatre as a place to explore these issues, and he wrote it very fast, and I think it was very deliberately something that just he wanted to put on, and it was a first draft. To use
and the same thing goes for, in a way, for Ross Sorkin's book, and I watched the dramatisation of that recently. Thought it was rather good, actually, but it does fall into that category of the sort of the scary. You come away feeling scared and not quite knowing how you can kind of deal with that, I think.
And, of course, one of the best books about the financial crisis came out in 2002, and that shows another thing about fiction. Well, this is Don DeLillo's Cosmopolis, right. A novel which looks forward. You know, that novels can be proleptic. They can prophesy as well as looking back. So, you know, it's very interesting that some of our brightest minds kind of can project forward into these things as well as looking back. And I guess that's maybe the difference between fiction and non-fiction. I don't know.
Yeah, a number of the books that people still consider the best. I think is it Charles Morris, Rich Trillion Dollar Meltdown, and Gillian Tett's Fool's Gold. They were kind of ahead of the curve.
Yeah,
because
absolutely.
Actually people who I think had a slightly different perspective on it. In Morris's case, he'd been a banker in different times and was very perceptive banking journalist in The Atlantic. And Gillian Tett, who'd done this PhD in social anthropology, they were better at understanding basically anyone who had a kind of different angle on it. In a kind of systematic way, was able to see things that other people couldn't see and couldn't believe that they couldn't see them.
Yeah.
And so I think that the prophecies, though they didn't help to avoid the crash, they were definitely there.
Alex, should we expect bankers to learn anything from these movies and novels and other dramatisations of what went wrong?
God, I don't know. All the bankers that I know have lost their jobs. And it's a morality tale. These are all morality tales. I mean, I think you look back to the greatest novel to interact with the world of finance, which is Trollope's The Way We Live Now, you know, it's a morality tale. And yes, we learn, our minds operate through these fictional structures. We learn things through stories. And so the more of these stories, as Peter says, the more of these stories we have, the more we pick away at the things that drove these people, the more we will understand. And that, you know, bankers are human too.
On that note, I think we'll wrap things up. Margin Call is released in the UK on January the 13th, and Alex Preston's second novel, The Revelations, will be published by Faber in February. Thank you to my guests, Alex Preston, Leo Robson and Peter Aspton, and thank you for listening. The Arts Podcast was produced by Griselda Murray-Brown. Goodbye.
For more downloads, go to ft.com/podcasts.
The latest episode of The Next Five podcast is out now, and it's all about AI and creativity. I speak to Doug Eck, Senior Research Director at Google DeepMind.
Creativity is part and parcel of humanity.
YouTube creator Danny Vidari.
AI can give us humans new ideas.
And Neil Maiden, Professor of Digital Creativity at City University London.
AI creates a lot of opportunities. I think it's a great leveler.
Listen to the full episode of The Next Five wherever you get your podcasts. Enjoy.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.